Those people that run the Alano Club, I'm really happy to be here today. My name is Michael. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. Michael. You know, it's really great to see people. There's a Warriors game going on. There's a funeral for our friend David who passed away. He used to be here years ago. And people come out of the clear blue skies to share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. It's just a blessing to be here. I would never, ever, ever choose something over this, anything. Of being here in a day, sunny, rainy, AA give me my life back, and as I'll explain later on, AA saved my life, the 11 step saved my mind. I didn't have 11 step practice till later, and I'll explain that in a minute. Being here with all of you, I know almost everybody in the room, and you know, we check our credentials at the door. I don't know or care what you do. I don't care whose car is outside. I just know that your spirit connects with my spirit, and that's why we're here. I just see spirit. I know what Jose has done and Joe's done and Liz and Gordon, but I don't think of you as what you do for a living. I just think of you as a recovering spirit that helps me stay sober. Everything I've ever wanted in my life, I found here, right here. And I didn't know how to find it until I started doing this. I'll explain that in a while. I knew the steps and I knew what they said, but I didn't start practicing the steps until I became desperate in AA, and as my story will tell you, I'll try and be brief because we don't have too many people here, and that's great for me, and I don't want to go on and on. I don't like speakers that chair for a long, long period of time, but I had the gift of desperation because I didn't come in until I was beyond ready. If there was one more cocktail or one more line of cocaine or one more drug, I'd still be out there. But my D-Day, my birthday, is December 9th of 1982. And last December, I celebrated 40 years. That's not what's impressive to me. What's impressive to me is, well, it's impressive that I didn't use or drink. But what's impressive is I kept rebirthing my life through the steps. I kept connecting with people that helped me go further. You know, I've said this before, but when Da Vinci designed the bicycle in 1400, he did something nobody else had done before. He put pedals on it. You know, before bicycles used to stride with your feet. And if I don't pedal forward in my bicycle of recovery, I'll fall over. So I'm always trying to do something. I'm always trying to work on a step. I'm always trying to pick up a sponsee. I'm always trying to talk to a spiritual friend. I'm always trying to find a conversation with Joe or Jose or Denise or Jack or Nancy and say, what are you doing for your program? I pick some women sometimes and say, how do you work your sponsees on the fourth step, fifth step? What do you do? I want to hear what you're doing. Because I love the way women sponsor women. And they, sorry to say, disappoint you guys, but they do it better than we do. They do, they just do. I see Liz and Denise and Nancy, I just see them sponsoring each other and they sponsor each other and they give each other the love. And men will do it to a certain degree and we finish the 12 steps and we say, see you later, you know? Or we go together, we do a lot of fun men things. And I've had the privilege of being at this fellowship, Contra Costa Fellowship. And I was at the fellowship in San Francisco for a couple months before I came here. And the thing that I did differently here than San Francisco is I joined the fellowship. I really joined the fellowship. I learned how to play golf with you guys. I learned how to cry with you guys. I learned how to go out and have coffee. I learned how to hang out with the boys and the ladies who are friendly and learn how to work the steps the other 23 hours. When I was trying to get sober in San Francisco, I was on my own. I'd live in an apartment. I'd been evicted from the apartment. And I'd go to meetings. A friend advised that I needed to go to meetings. And I liked that lady a lot. She had 2 years. And I never knew how she could get 2 years, but I knew her from college. And I'd go to the meetings in San Francisco. And after the meeting, after the Our Father, I'd walk home. No sponsor, no big book, no meeting list. You know how that ends. 24 hours, 30 hours later, I'm drunk. So I'm gonna go back to the start about, I grew up in a little tiny town called Trona, California. It's out in the Mojave Desert. I mean, it's in the sticks. It was the size of Cordelia, but it was 40 minutes from Death Valley. So the town had a huge dry lake called Ciro's Lake. It mined the brine out of the lake to make potash and soda ash. And my dad was a small town doctor there. My mom was a wonderful woman and a teacher. And she taught catechism on weekends. Only 3,000 people in the town. So when we were kids, we grew up there, and there was nothing to do except the drink. The parents would drink, and the kids would steal the liquor from the parents in the house. So we were, when we were 14 or 15 years old, we'd sneak into people's homes and drink the parents' liquor. We knew where their liquor cabinets were, and then we'd do the old trick of trying to fill their bottles with water. You golfers will appreciate this. Up behind our house was a sand golf course, all sand. You had to tee up every shot, or you dragged around a little piece of fake grass and you teed from that. And the golf club was a tiny house the size of this room. And most people at the golf club didn't have any clubs. They just went because it was a drinking place. And I used to go home, go down at 4 o'clock and say to my mom, you better get home because dad's coming home for dinner. And she was a wonderful lady. She's a great cook and a great mom. But when dad came home, you had to have dinner on the table. He was a very stern man, but very fair, but very stern. And he had a work car. He went to bed at 8 o'clock in the evening, and he got up at 4 to do surgery. So the requirement for us boys was you had to have the car in by 4 in the summer. And that was a close call, because a lot of times we would take his car, drive around out in the desert or go over to Ridgecrest and drink and carouse and trash the inside of the car. I remember one time opening the door at lunchtime because he came home for lunch. I said, well, I wonder what we did last night. We went to the drive-in, you know, those drive-ins. And the drive-in when you put two people in the trunk to save a dollar. And I looked in the back, and it was a drive-away. So in the back were vodka, scotch, and beer bottles, and a speaker from the drive-in. Because when you drive in, so not only did we drive away, the speaker went like this and swapped, and it flapped, hit the back of the door, damaged the door. And he had a temper. And he would yell at us once in a while, but he would had this smoldering silence, like, I know what you're up to, and don't do it again. So that didn't happen, because we had the car on summers, and we had a chance to take the car out. And many times we'd drive around out in the desert and come around the corner and run into an obstacle or get drunk and trash the car. He had a nice car for my mom, and he had a work car for himself. And the reason he had a work car for himself is because he had to replace it every 2 or 3 years. Because my brother and I would just trash it. So, some of the old, I haven't had a chance to share some of this early drinking days. Because when you share a meeting, you don't have a lot of time to go into some of your war stories. But when I went away to high school, my dad sent us away to high school because he came from a really poor family and he wanted us a good education. But going away to high school at 14 years old is really hard when you leave your family. And we lived down at Bellarmine in this boarding school in San Jose. And on weekends, all you could do is just, we had $5 allowance, hitchhike across town and buy some beer and drink with your friends. And we did that. And then when I got into later years of high school, we went home with guys on weekends and we'd drink with them. And by the time I got sent away to college, I went to a school back east where the drinking age was 18. And I got to the first big party, and it was just Katy bar the door. There was music, and there was glass on the floor, and people were taking their clothes off. I figured, I've arrived. This is what college is about. But I did. There's several lines. They say you cross the line in drinking. I crossed the first line probably in college because I drank alcoholically. When I had my date with my first wife a year or two later when she came to Georgetown, I remember going up to a soccer game first, and we were all drinking. I remember throwing up on my first date, not on her, but close to her. You know, it was like, and then when she wanted to get married a couple years later, I thought, what? I was 22 when she really wanted to get married because her friends were getting married. I'm just beginning the height of my disease. It's like she's proposing to Kurt Cobain or to Mick Jagger. It's like, are you looking at what's happening here? Because my identity was alcoholism. I liked the guys that were rat fuckers. I liked the guys that drank and used and caroused and carried on. I didn't dislike the straights have a new connotation now, but the serious conservative student kind of guy wasn't my guy, and the jocks weren't my guy. I liked the guy that didn't quite fit in, because I felt like I was always a little different. Not better than, different, and I didn't know what that difference was. I do now. The difference was a desire to find a spiritual program, to find a spiritual life. And I thought you had to do that by being slightly crazy. So my nickname when I was in law school and college was Rocket Man, because I was always acting out. I remember being in San Francisco, and after I went through law school, I went to the DA's office in Alameda County. I loved being a DA. It was really fun because we were good DAs. We were honest people. We didn't punish people overly. I ran the Fremont office with another guy, and we had the pretrial conferences where you have your meetings and you settle cases on Friday, and then the afternoon you see the judge. So I decided to have the pretrial conference at the Ranch Bar and Grill in Fremont, which is a great place, and we serve drinks and Bloody Marys and gin tonics at 11 o'clock in the morning. And if everybody, all the lawyers were there, we had a great time. We settled almost all the cases. And if we didn't like you, or you were out of town and you were mean to us, we just sent you to trial on Monday. So, you know, we'll see you on Monday, we'll go to trial. And I tried the cases with my buddies. There was lots of drinking in the DA's office, and really good guys. It was hard work because it could have been me. I'd stand at the counsel table and look down at the defendant and say, "I'm sorry you're here, brother. I was just doing my job." Like, I didn't have a mom or dad. Her dad was in prison and mom was on the pipe, you know? And I just said to myself, I'm only gonna charge the cases that are fair. I'm not gonna charge a case that's unreasonable. And several times I stood up and said, there's not enough evidence here, Your Honor. I'm not gonna proceed with this case. And the public defender, the defense attorney, "Are you kidding?" I said, "No, I'm not kidding. I can't do this because I don't see this is adding up to what's going on." And I had a really good boss named Lowell Jensen, who was a very fair DA. They don't make them like that anymore. Now there are a lot of ideologues who just want to get convictions at any rate. And now it's worse because there's more poverty and more guns. And I'm sad, you know, Joe's in the business that I'm in. And I'm just sad right now that the world's come to shootings and killings and drugs and people harming each other. And there's a epidemic of hatred among everybody. And it's sad. And you know what? It's not in this room. This is a safe place. I feel safe here. Page 85 says that. It says you'll find that you have a place of safety and you'll feel comfortable and protected. I felt protected from the day I walked into my first AA meeting. In the fall of 1982, that friend Ann invited me to a meeting at St. Paul's Episcopal. Most of the Episcopals are called St. Paul. I think he was one of their, and I love the Episcopal churches, I do. I went to St. Paul's on golf, right off of Van Ness, and Ann took me to that meeting. It was, I don't know if she was gay or not, it was a gay and lesbian meeting. Great meeting, wonderful people, and it was large. There was a lot of energy there, and I said, "This is really important. Something's going on here that's bigger than me." And the people did one thing I'd never seen a group that large do. They paid attention. They were listening with rapt attention to the speaker. And they come up afterwards and offered me phone numbers and stuff. I didn't know what that was. I didn't think I was getting picked up by a gay guy. I just meant they offered me, "We can help you. Keep coming back. Get a sponsor." I couldn't hear it. And so I didn't get sober till December 9th of 1982. And that's when they came in and helped me. I'll tell you that in a minute. So in my passion for outdoors, I've been a hiker, mountain climber all my life. I had a privilege of going to, I climbed Mount Shasta 60 times. I went up with friends and we'd stay a day or two and learn how to climb. And I got invited to a trip to Alaska to climb with Phil Urschler, who is a very famous, great guy. Built like Elwin. He's just, you know, strong and became a world-famous mountaineer. And he said, "You want to come to Alaska?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "For sure." He invited four of us to climb this 11-mile ridge, never been climbed before. It's right next to Denali. And we got to the Talkeetna. It was just a little tiny town where you go from Anchorage to Talkeetna. And Talkeetna is just, all it is a couple hotels, a bar, and airplanes. And those little planes that fly into Alaska. And we couldn't get into the Denali Glacier because there's too much bad weather. And my drinking accelerated. This is 1979, early part of 80. And I said, "We're drinking at this place called the Fairview Inn. It's filled with mountaineers, great place. It's like all those people either qualified for AA later on or they died. Those people were in that place and they could drink." And what happened in Alaska in the summertime, as you know, there's no sunset. It gets sunset slightly from 11 to 1, and then the sun comes up again. So by 2 o'clock, I was shit-faced with usually red wine. And I said to myself, every night I was passing out. And I said, I've been training really hard for this. If we don't get on that plane, I'm not gonna make it. And I trained really hard for this because it was the first ascent of a ridge that was called the Sultana Ridge. It was a series of peaks and cornices that go all the way up to 4 Acre, which is 17,800 feet. So the fourth or fifth night, the rains parted and we started up this ridge, and four of us would climb high and sleep low, and we took all of our supplies. You'd take a lot of gear and you'd come back and drop it and take it higher. And about the fifth night, I'm up there and I'm cooking. You're in a kitchen, you dig deep down in the snow, you put ice blocks around because of the wind. And I hadn't had a drink in a couple of days because we've been on the mountain for 3 days, and I reached into my big down parka. You have the equipment to climb in Alaska, it costs you about $2,000 or $3,000. Because it's down that makes you look like the Michelin doughboy. You just got down everywhere and you walk around like this. And they say if you don't like the weather in Alaska, just wait 5 minutes, it just comes in. And when it comes in, it just blows like horizontal stucco. So I'm cooking the dinner, I serve my mates down in the tent, and I reach into my pocket, and there's the marijuana, there's a joint. I don't know where that came from, but I think I'll smoke. Here I am at 10,000 feet, finishing cooking my friends and doing the dishes, I have my joint. So I crawl out of the kitchen, and I start to go back down to my tent, and I fall. And I'm sliding on the glacier. I didn't have my crampons on because I had down booties, and they don't have good traction. So I'm sliding down next to the tents, and as I go by, I grab an ice axe. That's the last bastion between me and the cliff. Needless to say, I didn't tell that to my roommates, that I had just fallen and almost died. But that little bit of marijuana, that little bit at night, would have killed me if I had not grabbed that ice axe. So that's what I do, you know. If you put a beer near me, it's mine. If you put a joint near me, it's mine. If you put white powder in front of me, I'll do it. That's what I did. And when I first got sober, my fear wasn't that I would have an urge to drink. My fear was it would appear somewhere and I would never say no. Because I'm impulsive and I take rash decisions all the time. So we made the climb. We went up and down this ridge. It was amazing. We were the second ascent ever to climb Sultana Ridge. And when I came back down, I said to myself, something's got to change. And about a year later, I got into AA and got sober, but not without some difficulty. The last couple months of my drinking was a nightmare. I got in touch with the first step, powerlessness, and my life was unmanageable. I'd moved to the inner Richmond. I rented an apartment that I couldn't afford. I don't know how I got into the apartment. I didn't have the money to stay there more than 6 months. I had a car that I'd sliced in half. My sister had a Thanksgiving party at her house in Marin County, just for the family, and I drank a lot. Thank God I gave my kids to my first wife. And I drove down the marina, literally sliced the car in half. And I had the smarts to walk away. It didn't get arrested for DUI, but that car never came back. My ex-wife wanted the car when I went to treatment, and I said, here's the pink slip, good luck. It was a Peugeot turbo diesel. I don't know how I lived to that, but one more thing I was going to say. When I was in law school in the 60s, and late 60s, early 70s, I had a chance to live in San Francisco and go to law school, and I loved the people in San Francisco. I loved the hippie movement. I was an anti-war activist with my ROTC uniform on, and I loved being part of the culture. And aside from the drugs and alcohol we did, there was a lot of good that we really tried to protest the war. We tried to say no thanks to Richard Nixon. And I remember one story is I had some friends said to me from back east, they said, we got two sisters who went to Mount Holyoke, or one of those little prep schools. We want to send them out and have you show them a good time in San Francisco. And I thought, oh, fuck, this is going to be interesting. So these two little prep, you know, the pleated skirts and the knee socks and the... A lot of you guys are too young for that, but these two gals came out, and I said, well, the place I go for fun is the Fillmore Auditorium. And it's amazing, crowded, fun, hot, good music from hot tuna to Carlos Santana, just great place, packed. And so these two gals come in, and I say, we're drinking and we're smoking, and the music's going wild. And I look over, and this gal hit the deck. She's on the floor, passed out from excitement and just the stress of this place. And I thought I was having a great time. So I got her to the fire escape and called the medic. He said she's fine. And I said, you stay here. Here's the medic's going to take care of you. Here's $20 for a cab, and I'll catch you later. That's what I did. So that's my idea of a good time in San Francisco. So getting back down to D-Day, I'd been evicted from that apartment, and I didn't have any place to go. So I would stay with friends or acquaintances, and I'd been left my job in San Francisco in 1980. I left this firm called Holberg, Finger & Brown. It was a really good firm, and they were good guys. Mr. Holberg was Swedish, and his son was named Eric, and I was an alcoholic. And I was the only one in that firm that wanted to help Eric because I knew he was dying from drugs. He lived out in Fairfax. And I came and found Eric's, and I drove him to the Walden House. I never know why I did, because I liked him a lot. Nobody else did. They thought it was a shame that Eric, the son of this prestigious lawyer, would be a drug addict. And I took him to the Walden House, and he stayed, and he made it. And he gave me a ficus as a gift, a tree. And I put the tree in my office. And people thanked me, but they was like, oh, you got rid of Eric. I'm glad you got rid of him. But in the law firm, they were good lawyers and wealthy lawyers and egomaniacs. And one of the guys, Phil Brown, was a big, fat alcoholic. And he was instrumental in saying, and I'm happy this happened. He said, Michael, you don't fit in here. You know, we love you, but you're kind of a little different. What he meant was saying is that you got this monkey on your back. And it was okay. I needed to leave because I wasn't a good fit. And on July 1st of 1980, I walked down Market Street, literally on the tracks, on the trolley tracks with a dolly, with all my books and the ficus from Eric and a six pack of beer on the top. And I said, my friend Jim Gagan was, not Bill Gagan, but Jim Gagan said, free legal advice, free legal advice. And I thought it was... And I thought, I'm in no shape to be given legal advice. So I went down, it was only two blocks. I went down to the Hobart building, which is a cool old building. It's an old building right on the corner of Market and Montgomery. And it's only about 22 stories. The top two stories, there's a turret with a balcony. And these guys who I knew let me practice law there, but I didn't have a secretary, I only had a couple of files left. And I walked down there, I got on the balcony, I looked down at the traffic on Market Street, and I got a six-pack of beer, a bottle of vodka, some marijuana, and some white powder. And I said, this is gonna be an interesting ride. No boss, no employer, no secretary, no program, no family. And I got the privilege of that last 18 months of getting in touch with step one. Days turned into nights, night turned into day. I didn't have any idea what day or night it was. I'd be living in the apartment that I got evicted from. I'd go into the Max's 540 Club. It was 540 Clement, but I called the 540 Club because I was there at 5:40 a.m. to get well. We called it getting well. At 5:40, I needed a drink. And I had the privilege of having to drink in the morning, like at 3 in the morning. I got the privilege of having to open the refrigerator. That's the last line. There's alcohol, then there's the alcoholic that drinks alcoholically, then there's the guy that can't stop. That's the line that I needed to do. I did not know that alcohol was physically addictive. I did not know that you couldn't stop. I did not know that you had to get up at 3 in the morning, go to the refrigerator, and take a hit. At 8 o'clock in the morning, I'd walk down to the Asian market, and I'd take my change out of the pocket, and I'd put my change on the counter, and this little Asian lady looked at me like, she wasn't saying anything, but she was saying, it's 8 o'clock in the morning, I know. You're already drunk, I know. How much beer do you want? I said, I can't pick up the coins. Just tell me how much this will buy. So I was hoping it'd be at least a couple of tall boys. I like the tall boys because they fit in the shampoo holder. That's a perfect place for a shampoo holder, is to put the beer. And then you get a couple of beers down, you're okay. So I want to fast forward to recovery. So what happened was, on December 9th, I had not been going to events in the East Bay. I had DA friends, lawyer friends. I had not been showing up for birthday parties or weddings or whatever. They came and said to me, "We haven't heard from you a long time." And I said, I'll be over there. Well, in November of 82, a friend of mine named John Pace committed suicide. He's a great guy, fun, public defender, great lawyer, hung himself. He was one of my running buddies. And in the note he left, he said, "I'm an alcoholic and I can't stand the stresses of life." His dad was a doctor and his girlfriend Jill had left him. So I said to myself, my friend said, "Michael didn't show up for John Pace's funeral. We know he's alcoholic. We'll come get him." So because of John's death and because of his note, they came and found me in the avenues of San Francisco, been evicted from my apartment, been living with people who, for a night or two. I'd go to the bars at 10 minutes to two and say, "I need a ride." And they say, "Where?" I said, "Your house." They said, "What?" I said, "Yeah, you got a sofa, don't you?" So I did. I stayed with a couple of gals who were pharmacists. They were pharmacy students. I stayed with my buddy from Georgetown named John, and I stayed with another guy down the street. But when the phone rang, on December 9th, the phone rang, and it was a guy who said, Your friends have called me looking for you. My name is Grish." And I said, "I don't know why I picked up the phone. It wasn't my apartment. It wasn't even cell phones back then. They were just coming in. I didn't have a cell phone." And he said, "I'll come and get you." So he sent my friend, John Connigan, who this guy was my friend from Georgetown. He died of alcoholism. Connigan, there's another name, Irish name. My mom's name is Rosemary Hennessy. There's a clue, you know? So Connigan gave me a ride over to Grish, and he said, I came into a room. There was an intervention, and Grish said, he did a 12-step call, a 12-step the way you're supposed to do it. He said, "I'm an alcoholic, and I'm happy. And I've got a fellowship of friends who love me." I'd never heard anybody say that they were alcoholic and happy. And he meant it. And he said to me, "You know, I know what you've been doing. I watch you've been doing. You're not staying sober between meetings, and I want to help you. And if you want to go away, we have some money for you. Would you want to go?" I said, "Of course. I had no choice. Either couch surf until I die or go to this treatment center." And he drove me to treatment, and my friends were in the room, and they supported me, and they came to treatment. And when I left that treatment center on January of 83, 5 weeks later, I had to stay a little later because I was so fucked up that it took me a week to detox. I didn't sleep. All the benzos and all the drugs were coming out of me. But when I left, we did a fifth step there, which is really important. When I left that treatment center, I had got on my knees and I said, "I don't know who's there, what's there, what this higher power thing is, but I need help with this thirst. I have had a thirst since I was 14. Please help me with this thirst because I have not been able to stop." And Grish drove me back to San Francisco and he said, "I want you to make sobriety your number one priority. Nothing else comes close." And I looked around and the thirst was gone. I didn't have the thirst ever again. I'm not saying I didn't think about it. I had the craving was gone. And I did what he said. I went to meetings every day. I got I found a temporary sponsor. And then I got a call from a friend named John Martinez, who invited me to come to Martinez and work with him. And one thing I did in the Contra Costa area, and I did here, was I joined the fellowship. I got a sponsor. I started working the steps. We started meetings in Contra Costa County. We started meetings at the hospital, Mount Diablo. We started a Thank God I Feel meeting in my building in Martinez. I didn't have a car. I rode my bicycle to meetings. I started doing triathlons and running. I ran so much in exercise that I had stress fractures. And Dr. Patmont from Berkeley said, you'll be on crutches if you don't stop running. So I bought a bicycle, used bicycle, and started riding to meetings. And that's how I got into cycling. But the fellowship saved my life. And the friends we had were really good guys and gals. And I came to Benicia. I was in trial for this guy named John. And we came over here and I said, where has this town been? I mean, I went to Sam's Harbor and downtown to the brewery, that place with the big mural. And I said, I love Benicia. And it's been my home ever since I came here. So fast forwarding, during the time that I was getting sober, I knew what the steps said academically. I read the steps. I knew what they said in the big book, but I wasn't practicing them. and 5 or 6 and 7 years sober, I'm still acting out. Lust, dishonesty, greed, whatever it was, I was not behaving. And I said, oh, I think there's a difference. It says practice these principles in all our affairs. I didn't read that part. I thought I was being a student. I thought I would get a B if I read the steps, and you guys would give me a B or put a star on my piano book, right? So I knew what they said, but it wasn't fun with 5 years sober still lying to people. Wasn't fun flirting with your office manager when you're married. Not fun. Not fun being late when you're promised to be on time. Not fun. So I didn't do this step work because I want to sound good in meetings, or because I did it because I want to be happy. I want to stay sober. And I stayed sober the first 5 years just on adrenaline and pink cloud. I didn't start to do the work until I really got desperate in recovery. And then something happened. I say this to people who are searching for a God of their understanding. For me, I didn't choose the God of the Creator God. That didn't work for me because I'd left that alone when I was a Catholic altar boy. That didn't work for me, so I just used the group and I used the energy of my friends. Then after I started to pay attention and started doing the work and getting rid of some of these character defects, a new voice showed up. Didn't know where it was from. Said, you can do better. Said, you can do more than not drink. Said, you don't have to lie anymore. That wasn't me. I don't know where that voice came from, but it came frequently. And the more I went to meetings, and the more I got quiet, the more a voice appeared to me, and that became my conscious contact. So for those who are new or nearly new, or it doesn't matter what you believe, it doesn't matter what you call your God, for me, if you have a conscious contact with some energy that wants you to wake up and wants you to be sober, that's it, bingo, forget the rest. So people, a lot of people think that we oh, you go to AA, you're a religious fanatic, or you have a God. No, we don't have a God problem. We have a God, people outside who don't know us have a God problem. We're not religion, and we have an understanding that something here can help us wake up. And it says in the book, it takes you right to the place. It says we have a spiritual awakening. Is that page 570 in the back? It says, we have found an inner resource that's an awareness of a power greater than ourselves. And for me, that showed up through the voices. I was sitting here, right over here, with a men's group. We started, Joe was there, and Ellen was there, and Bob Fonstock was my friend, and I hired him first as a therapist and a buddy, and he said, we're done doing the therapy, we're done with the, I don't want to be your sponsor anymore, I just want to be your friend and talk about recovery. And we did. And he said his office right over here, and God bless him, the kindest, smartest guy in the world, and still waters run deep. Quiet people like that scare the shit out of me because they're smarter than me and they don't flap their lips all the time like I do. And he had wisdom that was deep. And Joe knows, we would be men's retreat up in Great Eagle. Bob wouldn't say a word, but when he talked, every word was pure gold, pure gold. And I had the privilege of introducing him to Terry, the doctor friend who they got married, and they became really good friends, and he's sponsored. But he said, how about 84 to 88? Do you have a daily routine? And I said, no. He said, read 84 to 88 and start your daily practice. So I got deep into meditation and practice, and my life took off. And because of that, I found some fellowships around the area that are sanghas, meditation groups, Benicia, Point Richmond, and Marin County. Great people who meet and meditate and talk about life, and it's not religion. It's all simple teachings like impermanence, compassion. Yesterday I attended a day-long retreat on loving kindness for others and for yourself. And that's one thing I didn't do. In my eighth and ninth step, I made amends to people the best I could, but I wasn't making amends to myself. I wasn't forgiving myself. And I had self-loathing for the life I'd lived. And I didn't know until later in sobriety that you guys taught me that the answer to this whole thing is self-acceptance and self-love. Because I didn't like what I did, and I didn't like the person I'd become. And I didn't forgive myself for years. I don't suggest anybody wait till 10 years sober to do an 8 and 9 step thoroughly. But the 8th and 9th step for me is to love myself. So what I try and do now is I try and sit every morning. I can't start the day listening to this. The answers are in my heart. The heart doesn't have any fear. The heart knows what to do. The heart's not afraid of you or afraid of anybody. The ego is. what I try and do now with the programs help me do is to keep melting. Just keep melting the shell. That's what we talk about in the book. Self, page 60, 62. Selfishness, self-centeredness is the heart of our problems. We step on the toes of others and they retaliate, you know? Once we start to build the house of self, we start when we're 7 years old. I want to be hip, slick, and cool. I want to comb my hair nice. I want to flirt with the girls. I want to be a lawyer, doctor, probation officer, and all of that's just what we do. Inside is who we are. And the people in this room and the people in recovery keep melting. And they keep shedding all that exterior stuff because it doesn't do us much good. It'll help us get a job. It'll help us get to the supermarket. But ego is not our friend. Ego and awareness can't exist in the same room. There's either you're in ego, you're either in self or awareness. Either fear or love. They can't exist in the same room. So I try and live in awareness, and I ask for that every morning. I ask to be relieved of the bondage of self because my problem is Michael. It's always been Michael. I mean, alcoholism was a symptom of my disease. My disease is severe egotistical behavior. And there are people today in the world, you know who they are, who are narcissistic fools, and they're helping destroy our world. And, you know, some are in Russia, some are here, some are in China, and we don't fight back as much as we love back. We have to give love to each other. That's the only way to do it. And I think that there's a groundswell of love and recovery in AA and spiritual groups who are going to bring us back to life. I really feel the tides are going to turn. And I feel the young people want that. They don't want religion. They don't want to be told that there's heaven and hell, that they're going to be bad or good. They want to know that we can wake up to your true nature. I really believe our true nature is love and joy. And once we cover it with the bondage of self, we can't move forward. Lastly, I'll just finish with two things. I've experienced three different freedoms in my lifetime, in my recovery. One was freedom from alcohol and drugs, and I was blessed to have that be taken early. In the first 3 months, that was taken from me, as I explained. Second was the freedom from the bondage of self. That takes a while. You know, the selfishness, self-centeredness that we make amends. And the last one is what I've been able to slowly accomplish is the freedom of the mind. It really doesn't, I don't listen to the first thoughts. I don't listen to the discursive, the negative thoughts. I just let them go. My meditation has taught me that most of what I'm thinking is not true. It's not real and it's not helpful. So I say thank you and I say goodbye to it. If we're free in the mind, there's no other. Socrates said that's the first and last freedom, because if you're free of the mind, you don't let things get to you. Nelson Mandela was in prison in South Africa for 22 years, and the guards wanted to be next to him. The guards wanted to go into the cell to sit with him because he was free. And when he came out, he led South Africa to away from apartheid into freedom. And Martin Luther King learned from him. Learn from Mandela and learn from the people who were suffering and learn how to protest through nonviolence. So I practice nonviolence and I practice the life of AA. When I was out of the hospital, I went through a depression, anxiety. I came out of the hospital and a teacher I love named James Barras is well known at Spirit Rock. And I went to see him. I said, James, I need to see you. I went to your retreat. And it was on loving kindness. And he said, you can come to my house. I said, great. He said, really? James Barras, you invite me to your house? This guy was a founding father of Spirit Rock, and he's written five books. Classic, Jewish, brilliant teacher, kind as can be. He's got his Levi jacket and Birkenstocks. I walk into the living room. We're sitting there, and I'm going, oh, I went through this divorce. He's, Michael, I know. Oh, I heard you on the retreat. I know. I go, you don't understand. You don't understand my pain. So he said, I went to Mount Shasta. I was going to move to Mount Shasta. He said, I know. I said, could we just sit for a minute? Which is a polite way of saying, would you just shut up? He's really a nice man. So we sit for 5-minute meditation. And I'm sitting next to him. And he said, I want you to put your hand on your heart. I said, okay. He said, I want you to say something. A prayer that worked for me a long time ago that my friend Howie taught me. I said, what is that? He said, put your hand on your heart and say, I love you, Michael. Keep going. I put my hand on my heart and I said, I love you, Michael. Keep going. And the tears just flowed. I had, in that 1 hour of meeting with James, I had more freedom and more awakening than 3 years of therapy with a really nice guy in Walnut Creek. And I said, James, I want to thank you for that. What I owe you, he said, you don't owe me a thing. Just pass it on. So thank you for listening.
Thank you.
And again, thank you.
Thank you, Michael.